Blog Talk Radio.
From deepest, darkest Africa, across the polar ice cap, spanning the jungles of South America, without a compass, without a map, Blog Talk Radio and Wildlife Educational Services presents Larry Batson's Wild World. Discover the wonders of the natural world with nationally known wildlife educator Larry Batson as we visit his wild world.
Hello, everyone, from the remote jungles of Clinton Falls, Indiana. Pine Mountain Valley, Georgia. This is Larry Batson, and welcome to Larry Batson's Wild World on a Thursday night. And our technical producer tonight, all the way from Mississippi, Henry Mays, stepped in for Eric Altman to man the controls, monitor the chat room. If you have calls tonight, you can call in questions, because we've got a fantastic guest. That number, for those who may not know, is 347-855-8123. And also, while you're on the Blog Talk site, Marcus is one of your favorites. It's very important, I'm told. I don't know what it does, but Marcus is a favorite. We greatly appreciate it. And as weeks go by, our audience is building. We have listeners all around the world. A big hello to New Zealand, England, Ireland, and, of course, our prayers with old Slade Monk down in Alabama. His father is, we'll just say he's a little bit under the weather, so we're praying for Slade and hope everything works out for him. I've got news for those listeners in Indonesia. I've just read on the internet that you can no longer take your water buffalo to any protest. So if you're planning on doing that, for our listeners in Jakarta and Celebes Island and throughout Sumatra, you can't do it anymore, folks, so we're sorry. So you got to leave the water buffalo at home. I have to confess to everyone, especially our listeners here in the United States, we are from Indiana. I am a Indianapolis born and raised resident, even though now I reside on our animal compound in Clinton Falls, Indiana, but I have on my Indianapolis Colts hat as we anticipate the Super Bowl of 4 days away. I can't wait. So I'm sorry, New Orleans, but I don't think this is going to be your year. I just hope I did not jinx them. Expecting big snows here in Clinton Falls, and as I was talking to our guest moments ago, I guess big rain out in the southeastern part of our United States. So the weather's going to be very interesting for the next few days. And I was discussing this with a friend in Virginia, and he told me, this can't be true. This absolutely cannot be true. But he told me that they're expecting, he has to be lying, 40 inches of snow. So if you're in Virginia and that's coming your way, man alive, our prayers are with you. I'm going to tell you right now, 40 inches. I can't even comprehend that. So hopefully we'll just get the little bitty 6 to 8 inches and just make everything a mess, miserable to drive in, and we'll see what happens. This week on the program, I have an old friend with us. In fact, I think I've known this man for probably close to 25 years. It's hard to believe. He has done something that I've always admired. He is a educator, just as like myself, except he works with birds of prey. Birds of prey from all over the world. In fact, I can still remember going down to Weekiwachi in Florida. And we arrived one evening, and my guest was chasing one of his macaws that had somehow eluded one of his caretakers. And there was the bird way up in a tree. And I believe he spent most of the night in. But the most amazing thing is he captured the bird. And it was truly impressive. But all the way from Pine Mountain Valley, Georgia, educator. He says he doesn't like the word falconer, but so we'll just call him wild birds of prey handler, Mr. Steve Hotty. Hi, Steve.
Hey, Larry. How you doing?
All right. How are you doing? That's the question.
25 years, huh?
I think it's been 25 years. I was trying to remember the first time we met, and we could have been up in Maryland at the big park that they were trying to put together. Gosh, what was the name of that place?
The Wildlife Preserve.
The Wildlife Preserve.
In Maryland, yeah, that was.
Yeah. What they call
it though? That was in 76. That was Wildlife Preserve, but that was in 76.
Couldn't have been then. That's too soon.
No, I met you, I think, on my way going to Jim Fowler's place. We had a stayover, and I had his son with me, Mark Fowler. You remember Mark.
Oh, right, the son of Jim.
Yeah, we did that outdoor program there right outside of Indianapolis. We brought our Birds of Prey out there.
And I want to tell
you,
that's
the first time I ever flew a falcon at night.
I was getting ready to talk about that. That was amazing. You had a peregrine falcon. Now young Mark Fowler, he was just basically beginning his falconry career. And he was totally petrified that bird, because you normally don't do it at night.
Well, yeah, and Mark was pretty young then too. He was probably about 14, 15 years old.
Was he that?
I think
young?
You put him on stage. I think you put him on stage and handed him a mic and walked away, if I remember right.
That doesn't sound. Yes, it does sound like me. I take that back. Well, all I can remember is that. Go ahead.
But now he's in the. He's producing and doing his own films now, kind of.
Well.
Following his father's footsteps and.
He is.
Doing documentaries and working for outdoor programs and whatnot.
Well, we had him on the show. Gosh, it's been about a month ago, and we talked about his documentaries he's done for National Geographic, the Hunt for the Samurai Subs. What I was really impressed with, and I'm sure he's told you about this, is the one they did where they took the Special Olympic athletes up Mount Kilimanjaro.
Right.
And
yeah, I think that was his second trip up there.
Yeah, and the first time he didn't make it to the summit, and this time he did. And I told him, I said, boy, those kids must have been really excited. And he said,
you know it.
He said it was life-changing. He said it was absolutely life-changing. He said it was unbelievable, but anyway. But we're here to talk about Steve Hotty tonight. And you know, you're now in Pine Mountain Valley, Georgia, and you're still, like myself, you're doing the education work with your Birds of Prey. How many Birds of Prey do you have right now, Steve?
Oh, let's see. We've got about 12 raptors, Birds of Prey. But, you know, they're changing a lot of the definition of Birds of Prey now with the DNA studies coming out. So, like the condors are now storks. They're more, through the DNA studies, they're more closely related to storks. Even peregrine falcons are more closely related to parrots than they are to hawks and eagles. But
really?
It's funny as things that we've been taught all of our lives, and we think we have a pretty good grasp of it, then they go and they change the rules on you. But I think that's the amazing thing about wildlife is the more you think you know about something, the more you find out that you're just scratching the surface.
When did you first start, getting attuned to the outdoors and your first birds that you worked with or your first animals that you worked with? When did that all start?
Oh, geez, that was in junior high school, I guess, is when I first became interested in birds and snakes and lizards and all that good stuff. And my dad was in the service, in the military. We moved around a lot, and so we went from Alabama to California, back to Alabama, then back to California. We ended up retiring down in Southern California, and at about a 2-3 mile hike home through the hills, and it beat going on the bus because you'd have to wait a long time, and there was a nice gully, and we could hike through the hills, or I'd hike by myself through the hills, and there would always be all kinds of gopher snakes and king snakes and garter snakes and stuff. And I remember I found a barn owl that was injured, and I threw a jacket over it and brought it home, and that thing screamed at me. It was like the devil incarnate. That would have been in the mid-60s. I got the bird home, and the thing screamed so much, I thought it was putting a curse on me. Yeah, I was just a kid back then. I wasn't sure what it was, and ended up letting it go later on that night, and it flew off okay. And I told my teacher at the junior high school about it, and he told me about an instructor that was a falconer at the high school. At the time, I didn't even know what a falconer was. And when I found out that it was that you could go out and legally possess birds of prey, and you hunt with them and work with them, I thought that was just the neatest thing in the world. So for the next 3-4 years, I studied and everything before I even got a bird, before I really figured out what was going on. But by the time I was out of high school, I'd learned to become a falconer and met the teacher and got my interest in biology and the outdoors and outdoor education. Of course, back in those days, you know, coming home on Sunday nights, you know, we got to watch Tim Fowler wrestle the animals, you know. That was
right.
Sunday night television. That and Disney World was the two programs that were a must back in those days. But been doing it ever since.
Well, after the owl, what was the first bird that you worked with?
It was a kestrel falcon. A lot of people know them as a sparrow hawk, but it's a real common, it's the smallest falcon that we have in this country. And it's a good bird for a beginner at the time, at least we thought it was. They're a little bit more time consuming as far as their care and everything. But back then, you know, all you had to do is you'd send $10 in, and they'd send you a multiple choice test and issue you your license. It was pretty simple. Now it's the most regulated of all the sports. You have to have federal and state licenses and go through federal tests, and a lot better now for the sport. So, because it is so time-consuming, it's not something that's taken lighthearted.
You
7 days a week.
Kind of
like milking the cows, you know.
All right. Well, that's one of the things that I've always... People will come up to us and say, boy, I would love to have your job. I'd love to work with animals. And I tell them it's not really a job. It's a life.
Yeah, so say, you got a couple of weeks, come on out.
Yeah, it's your existence, man. I mean, that's all you do. I mean, from the moment you wake up to the moment you go to bed, you've got a responsibility or responsibilities, and they just grab you. In fact,
it's a really big, really big. Yeah, you're absolutely right.
I was out.
You're saying?
I'm sorry.
There's a little delay there. What was that?
I said I was out this afternoon, and we had a little milder weather, and I heard the barred owls back in the woods behind our house. Of course, they have a pretty distinctive call. And I still remember we had a barred owl that had fallen out of the nest, it seems like this one hen would, she'd put her nest in this tree that every time we'd get a big thunderstorm, one or two of the babies would come out. It seemed like every other year we were finding a baby on the ground. And we'd just feed it long enough before it was free. We'd release it right here in our own woods. But I can remember... You'd called over here because I'd had some questions on raising this thing and getting ready to just, you know, release it back into the wild. And my wife Cheryl said something to the fact that, Larry's doing pretty good with this, but he's really having a problem cutting up the rats.
Yeah, it's a lot easier to feed snakes, isn't it?
Oh, no. She said you started laughing hysterically and telling her. She says, oh, no, they're like snakes. They'll swallow those mice and small rats whole. And you got... And we had Tupperware in our refrigerator. Well, in fact, I can still remember my sister-in-law was over, and we had Tupperware with these rats that I'd made into pieces for this owl. And Cheryl said to her, she said, now be careful which one of those Tupperware containers you open, because it was not pretty at all. But anyway,
I think if people knew what we had in our kitchens and bathrooms and refrigerators over the years, they wouldn't come anywhere near.
Well, I can still remember several years ago when I had you come in to Cleveland, Ohio, and do the big sports show there for 10 days. And you, and you brought, gosh, I'm trying to remember what you brought over. I think you brought an eagle. I couldn't tell you what type right off the hand. I know that you brought a falcon or two. But the very next year, we were all staying there at the Holiday Inn by the big IX Center, and... one of the people the Holiday said something to the fact that, hey, your buddy that was here last year, he left a couple of frozen rats in our cooler.
Could have been me, because the rats always get eaten around us pretty quick. They don't last that long.
I said, I don't know if they were Steve's or not, but that was a moment of hilarity for sure. So you started working with Birds of Prey, and then what was the next step? Where did you go from there?
Well, when I was working with raptors and Ellison going to school, I kind of quickly found out that most of my reports or anything I was doing in school kind of revolved around the birds. And I remember reading this, of course, in our area in Southern California, we'd see golden eagles down there. And reading about golden eagles and falconry was like, wow, that was like the ultimate in the history of golden eagles being flown in falconry. At that time, there was only a few people that had ever flown them in this country, only the Kyrgyz tribesmen in Tibet and whatnot were the falconers that had flown eagles, and they actually hunted animals as big as wolves with them, which is pretty incredible, because
yes.
A big eagle is only going to weigh 12, 15 pounds at the most, but to be able to take a 150-pound wolf just gives you an idea of how much power that they have in their feet. But anyway, I heard about this guy that was a writer for National Geographic and a wildlife photographer, and he was also a rehabilitator, and he happened to have eagles that he was rehabilitating for Fish and Wildlife and the Audubon Society in Los Angeles. That was David Sidden. And I pursued his name, and
introduced myself to him, and within 2 weeks I had one of his golden eagles. He'd never flown a bird before, and was looking for a chance to be able to try to get these birds back into the wild. And also, being a wildlife photographer, he'd like photographing the birds once I had it trained. And he ended up really liking this eagle that I had, and ended up writing a story about the releasing of this golden eagle. It was kind of at the same time as Grizzly Adams came out. And he ended up selling the story as a movie. And he was going to have me in the movie as kind of a silent movie, like, you know, kind of like the Disney movies with a voiceover and everything, because I wasn't an actor or anything. And next thing you know, they had a whole script for me, and it turned into a full production. We ended up moving up to Oregon and doing the film called Their Only Chance.
And what was it called again?
Their Only Chance.
Okay.
But it turned out, I think it was my only chance in the movie industry. The film was well liked by people that saw it, but when they went to produce the film, they had hired a rival company to help produce it, and these guys actually quit their company and went to work for our company, and they proceeded to spend all the money that they had in about 3 weeks for production. So it only played in a few areas, but I think it actually played in the Midwest as part of the test market. The Midwest, Oregon, Seattle, Washington, and played in a little bit of Northern California before they went broke. But years later, I was able to find the film, and sometimes you can find an old VHS copy out on eBay if you're lucky. I think the highest price was probably about $5 for the film, and the lowest was a nickel. So,
well,
but we worked for 3 years on that film.
And what was involved with it? Did you work with other types of wildlife in the film?
Well, it was a story of a boy who befriended an eagle, a cougar, and a coyote.
Oh, I see.
And it was roughly based on a rehabilitation center that I had started down in Southern California, and that was in 76. And the kind of a story of, you know, real loose story of this kid that releases this eagle. But we had the principal artist in it, or actor, was Jock Mahoney. Or Jocko Mahoney. If you ever saw the movie Hooper with
right.
Burt Reynolds and Sally Fields, that movie was based on the life of Jocko, who was a stuntman.
Oh.
And he was also Sally Fields' stepfather. And he was also played Tarzan. And he was like the seventh Tarzan, and the only Tarzan that did his own yell, his own Tarzan yell. But
ooh.
Real neat guy.
Yeah.
But needless to say, the movie didn't make a career for us. I ended up going into construction for about 10 years. But in the process of working in the industry, I'd met Jim Fowler. And he kind of taught me a lot about doing the wildlife education and going out and doing the public speaking and public programs with animals, which is, I think right now, I think we're kind of an endangered species in a way, with the way the laws and whatnot are getting tighter and tighter every year. You know, it takes a... Just to go into California to do a school program,
it cost me $1,000 to be able to go into that state just to get a permit to be able to educate kids.
Wow.
Which,
that's
of course,
sad.
I can't do now. Oh, it's really, really sad. And the kids are the ones that the public is the ones that really end up hurting in the long run. But
well,
other states, I've had them send the permit money back and say thank you for educating our kids. You know,
really,
so it's kind of funny how the different laws are depending on where you're at.
Well, it is, and in Indiana they are mildly strict, and I know places like Tennessee. We tried years ago to take our rattlesnake show in there, and I did not think that Tennessee would have any regulations whatsoever because of the churches in Tennessee, the snake handling churches. And it's Tennessee, the state's full of snakes. And I was told 2 days before we were to go to do the sports show in Nashville that the jail was 6 blocks from the convention center, and that if I brought a rattlesnake into Tennessee that they would arrest me. So I said, okay, what type of permits do I need so we can get this put together? And you cannot get a permit. They said, it's absolutely impossible. There's no way we will issue you a permit to do this type of program. Absolutely impossible. And he said, and the residents of Tennessee are glad that we have laws like this. I was told by the Tennessee Wildlife Resource Agency. Well, when we ended up going to the sports show, we couldn't take any rattlesnakes, so we took pythons and beetle monsters, African frogs and other things. Had huge crowds. And when I told people this, they said, what? They weren't even aware that such a law existed. It kind of slid through before anybody in that state, educators or anything, had a chance to band together and do any type of protest or work with the local legislators. They just kind of slid right on through, and they told me that, and they also told me that that if I wanted to talk bad about them for having these laws, they thought that was great, so that they would just get the word out more that you can't do that sort of thing. So it was. And I frankly told the man, I wish I could remember his name, but I said, I am really glad, sir, that I, as a child, did not grow up in Tennessee. Because the way the regulations are, I couldn't even take a toad hopping across my garden and put it in an aquarium in my bedroom, and that was illegal. And
yeah, what's the state motto of Tennessee? Isn't something like... I'm not sure. I'm not going to try to quote it, but
I'm not either.
Thought it was something to do with Davy Crockett and independence and freedom and kind of things. But you know, I thought it was one of those freedom states. But that's the problem. I mean, we've got so many self-interest groups now. Fortunately, we haven't had any problems over the years. We've certainly been looked at over the years, and I think they pretty much enjoy our message and whatnot. But you know, the problem with people keeping animals is becoming, you know, the political poster child for a lot of organizations, and they're kind of missing the whole point, I think, of what we do. And if people don't see these animals, they're not going to care about them.
Well, that's right. And I've always said that when we do a program, and for instance, today we were in Newcastle, Indiana. We did a couple programs. We had, 200-400 kids per show. But I know when we speak to these kids, we're not speaking to future zoologists or biologists necessarily, or conservationists or whatever, but these kids are going to grow up and vote, and their vote's going to decide that we have places like Yellowstone National Park, and we need to put millions into our park system and state forests.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yeah. Well, I was watching a news program the other day, and they were talking about some of these earmarked monies that were being wasted. And one of the examples that they had plenty of good examples of wasted taxpayer money. But then they said, and can you believe it? They're building tunnels for turtles. For turtles. They're spending $2 million on tunnels for turtles because the turtles are all getting wiped out on the highways. And,
right.
I mean, he couldn't even name the species. He didn't care what species they were. They don't realize that turtles have to go out of their water to go nest. And when you put a highway across their traditional migration routes, they're going to get wiped out. Florida,
right.
And until recently, we had 600 people a day moving into the state. I mean, Florida's getting wiped out. You can't believe it. I don't know when the last time you've been down there, but since I've been going down there, the population and between Tampa and Gainesville and Clearwater and that area, it's just quadrupled. It's just wall-to-wall people now.
Oh, it's
sad. It's just sad. We've got to fight for, it's not just for the tunnels, for the turtles, but it's a lot of other things that they use those tunnels as well, the deer and rodents and everything else, but it's not just so turtles can go back and forth under what's this world going to be? You know, there's a lot of countries in Europe where the primary species are pigeons, starlings, and English sparrows, and that's all you see. You don't see the songbirds or anything. They've all disappeared. And I just don't understand how these people that they claim to be God-fearing people, how can they take one of the Lord's creatures and just say, well, it's getting wiped out. It's too bad because we put these roads in and we don't need to make places for them. And that just doesn't make sense to me.
Not at all. Well, we're going to take a break. We're with Steve Hoddy from Pine Mountain Valley, Georgia. This is Larry Batson's Wild World. We're going to have a few public service announcements. We'll be back in just a few moments, and you're listening to Blog Talk Radio.
Stay tuned. We'll be back with more of Larry Batson's Wild World here on Blog Talk Radio.
Take me fishing and show me how to drive the boat.
Take me fishing, so I can tell you what a great dad you've been.
Take someone you love out on the water and see where the water takes you.
Take me fishing because I miss my boy.
Rediscover the joy of boating and fishing. Get information and get going at takemefishing.org.
Duty, freedom, country, family. They're the values that make America strong and what our armed forces are fighting to defend.
While many talk about these ideals without action, they are just empty words.
If you think America's military families deserve more, log on to thanksusa.org. It's a great way to thank our troops and give military families the gift of education.
thanksusa.org. Scholarships for America's military families. You can make a difference.
Hi, this is Paul McCartney on behalf of RAD. If you're drinking, you can't drive my car or any car. Remember, if you're partying this holiday season, don't drink and drive. Got it? It's just not worth it. Doesn't make sense. Thank you.
A public service message brought to you by the U.S. Department of Transportation, RAD, the National Association of Broadcasters, and the Ad Council.
We're Rascal Flats. There's a place where ordinary people do extraordinary things every day. That place is called the American Red Cross. When you help the American Red Cross, you help America. Call 1-800-RED-CROSS or visit redcross.org to learn more.
Hi, this is Pat Green. The blood supply is at critically low levels, and you can help. Call the American Red Cross at 1-800-GIVE-LIFE. That's 1-800-GIVE-LIFE. Schedule your appointment to donate blood. Your donation is critical because every 2 seconds someone in America needs blood. That's accident victims, surgical candidates, and cancer patients, just to name a few. Please donate blood and encourage your friends, family, and neighbors to give too. Please call the American Red Cross at 1-800-GIVE-LIFE or visit givelife.org to make your appointment. Thank you.
Ranger Station, Ranger speaking.
Yeah, hi. I'd like to report a bear sighting.
Location?
In the forest, near the side of the road.
No need for alarm, sir. The forest is where bears live.
But this was no ordinary bear.
No ordinary bear?
Yeah, 1 second, I'm having a smoke taken in the view. Next thing I know, I am face to face with Smokey Bear.
Let me guess, Smokey had a tip for you.
He did. He must have seen me toss my cigarette on the ground. He told me never to do that because it only takes one spark to start a wildfire.
He's a smart bear. Did you know that 9 out of 10 wildfires are caused by humans? That means 9 out of 10 wildfires can be prevented.
That's what Smokey said. I had no idea.
That's why Smokey's famous, and you're not.
Good point.
Get your Smokey on. If you see someone in danger of starting a wildfire, step in and make a difference, because 9 out of 10 wildfires are caused by humans. Brought to you by Smokey Bear, the U.S. Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council. Learn more at SmokeyBear.com.
Only you can prevent wildfires.
Welcome back to Larry Batson. Wild World here on Blog Talk Radio. Once again, here's your host, Larry Batson.
Hello, everyone. This is Larry Batson. Welcome to Larry Batson's Wild World. Here every Thursday night at 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Next week on the show, my good friend Peter Weimer from Chautauqua Lake up in New York, and we're going to talk about musky fishing, and he's the ambassador for musky. I'm hearing one of Hottie's parrots or something. And he's the ambassador for Chautauqua Lake, and they've got some great programs with kids and boating and fishing, and it's going to be really great. So hopefully they won't get snowed in, and we'll have Mr. Weimer next week right here on Larry Batson's Wild World. My guest this week is, he's the Birdman of Pine Mountain Valley, Georgia. Steve Hottie, bird of prey educator and naturalist, a good friend for quite a long time, well over 20 years, and we've worked together several times. In fact, I can remember Steve down in Thomasville, Georgia. Do you remember that day?
when you were walking your bears.
Let me explain something. By the way, what kind of bird are we hearing in the background? I know my listeners want to know.
It could be the macaw,
yeah,
or the double yellowhead parrot.
That's what I think it is.
It's probably the double yellowhead.
You have a regular, you rescue parrots, is that right?
Yes, all our birds are donated birds to us. We do a lot of Renaissance festivals around the country. People may have seen us. And we did the Birds of Prey program at the Renaissance festivals. And people started asking us to please take their parrots to give them a home. So we ended up adopting their parrots, and now we've got about 30 parrots of all different various shapes and sizes.
You know, my wife, we only have one bear. Oh, yeah.
Talking about walking bears, though, down there.
We'll do the bears. But we were in Thomasville, Georgia for an event with Jim. In fact, I can still remember Steve. Jim called me. He said, hey, his wife, Betsy, is quite the artist. She was putting on an exhibit for this art fair, and he was down there doing lectures. And people don't realize this, but Jim Fowler really does not have animals. But he knows guys like yourself and myself that are willing to fill their truck up with our menageries and drive to who knows where and do programs. And, over the years, I know you've been to a ton of places, but I can still remember loading up my animal truck, because it was like you know, the typical notice on one of these events is like never a week. It's more like 2 or 3 days. And he said that's pretty advanced for him. So he says, in his gym file, he says, come on to Georgia and bring some animals. This is a wonderful place. We'll do some lectures. So I load up the old animal truck, and I can still remember, he said, Thomasville, Georgia. And I never looked at a map. I just started heading south. And I think I left Indianapolis I'm thinking like 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon. So I'm heading south, and I, go ahead. So I just crossed the Georgia line, and I'm thinking, I better look at a map and see where Thomasville, Georgia is, because I didn't have a clue. And I realized that it was almost in Florida. So I didn't get there till like 7 in the morning. So I drove all night and got to a room and got everybody taken care of and whatnot. We went to this hall, and where we did the presentation was on the second floor in this auditorium. And basically the way to get the animals up to the auditorium where we were doing this, on the stage where we were doing this presentation, they called it a stairway, I called it a fire escape. And we'd walk the animals up this fire escape and into this room. Well, I had two bears. In fact, luckily enough, I had talked to you beforehand, and you had a chance to kind of get to know them, because any animal person knows, of all the animals to work with, bears are probably the toughest, next to primates, because they're so intelligent.
And they can hurt you.
And they can hurt you. So I've got these two black bears. I don't know what they weigh. I think they probably went 100 pounds apiece, wouldn't you say?
Oh, yeah, easily.
Easily. So I've got the two of them up on this stage, and it's dark outside. And I've got the animal truck, my van, parked at the bottom of these steps, with the plan is I go out the door and we'll go down these steps and into the truck, and it's going to work out fine. So I go out the door, and the audience gives us a round of applause. That alarmed the bears. They went out the door. Instead of going down their fire escape, they just took a flying leap over the edge of the railing. And literally,
four or five foot drop.
I think it was more than that. It was a long way. It looked like forever, because there I was hanging over the railing.
Well, you have to remember that there were two bears, and
right.
You had both bears, but yeah. One bear was on one side of the rail, and the other bear was on the other side of the rail, and you were in between the rail holding on to these bears.
Just kind of hanging over
it. You didn't know what to do.
And luckily, you had a young man with you, and
Josh,
you said,
yeah.
Well, you guys grabbed him, but I'm going to tell you right now, it was so hard to let go of those leads, because any animal
you
handler...
You didn't watch it. We're like, Larry, let go. You go, I can't let go. You got to let go.
And I guess, there's a security guy.
The movie would be good.
The movie would be excellent. There was a security guy that came around the corner about the time this is all coming down, and he saw those bears take a flying leap off that balcony, that railing, and he just turned around and went the other way. He said, I wanted nothing to do with that. Bears and whatever. But it worked out fine.
Yeah.
You guys grabbed the leads and the bears. We patted them on the head and put them. The bears weren't harmed, and they went in the truck. But the female bear would not go back up there. I think the next day I had to coax the male bear with an apple, and he did it. But
that worked out pretty good. Jim always had a way of being able to relate the animals with the audience, and remember he had that tent set up with a cooler. And had the bears tearing down the tent on stage.
I want to tell you. And, you know, for some strange reason, it seems like whenever I had bears with him, there was always an event. I can still remember those we had two other bears. In fact, their names were Abe and George. And we were in Akron, Ohio, and we were doing an event for the Akron Zoo. It was the second. It was on the second floor of this hotel. And I asked the people at the zoo, I said, "You knew we were bringing animals. Why do you make it so hard for us to get these animals to where we're going to do this presentation?" Because it seems like it would always be that way.
Yeah.
But it was on the second floor. So these bears that we had with us, they were bigger bears. They were in the 300, 350-pound range. They were well over a year old. They were coming right along. Well, to get up to where the event was, we had to ride an elevator. So we put the bears on the elevators, and the bears weren't liking the elevator. I mean, that movement stuff, that made them real wary. So we went out and did the presentation, and I think there was, I don't know how many people was in the audience, probably a couple hundred, I guess. It was a big dinner and a big lavish event for the Akron Zoo. So here we are in the hotel, and we leave with the bears. Well, we're trying to get back on the elevator to go back to our truck to put the bears in the truck. And those bears weren't having it. They were not getting on that elevator. And here was all these people in the dining hall where we just left, and they could hear those bears in the hallway going, row, row. You know, they kind of, row, row. So basically what we had to do is we had to make a mad dash for the steps because they were getting ready to let out because the program was over. And I could see us in the hallway with those two bears, and all of a sudden we'd be surrounded by people. So we had to make a beeline for the stairway, and the bears they didn't like to go downhill very well. They don't like to go downhill fast, let's put it that way. So here we were, and the bears were complaining about, I'm sure the people in there thought, what in the heck is going on in there? But anyway, that's part of the deal, part of the life. People have no understanding. They have no comprehension of that's probably why they have gray hair and my beard now. So you do the Renaissance Festival. Now, Steve, I've given you a hard time about the men in tights.
Hey, I tell you though.
Tell me though.
If it wasn't for Renaissance Festivals, we probably would have. Well, we've been doing something else, but they've been really good at supporting us and providing a venue for us to be able to get out with our animals, mm-hmm. where, as you know, it's really hard to get work lecturing and getting where you actually getting paid decent. I think when it comes to the pay scale, anybody that wants to get into wildlife, if you think you're doing it for money, you're definitely doing the wrong business, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely, yeah.
Go to school, go to work, go corporate, do whatever. Because if you don't, you're going to end up like a lot of us, without health insurance and without a lot of things that a lot of people get with normal jobs.
Right.
You know, and we'll be working the rest of our lives. And there's no doubt about that.
We'll be working until they dig the hole.
That's right, and Renaissance Festivals will keep hiring us as long as they will. We do a lot of school programs, too. We go out to Texas every year, and we started out about 5-6 years ago doing some school shows promoting the migration celebration in March at San Bernard Wildlife Refuge near Jacksonville, or Lake Jackson, Texas. In Brazoria area, Brazoria County. We started out doing 6-7 schools in about 2 weeks. Now we're up to 30 schools, and it's all community supported, businesses, local businesses and whatnot, supporting us to go to all the different schools now. But now the kids all come out to their event, their migration celebration, and they tell their parents and everything, come out and see the animals and learn more about what's going on. So it's become a pretty big deal for us out there.
What exactly is involved with this event? I mean, what type of birds are we talking about migrating?
Oh, geez, as far as raptors, you've got peregrine falcons, merlins, Cooper's hawks, broadwing hawks, that are, some of them are migrating all the way from the tundra down to South America, and they go right along the coast and through Padre Island and down into Mexico, and some go as far south as Argentina. But you also get all kinds of songbirds, painted bunnings and indigo bunnings and warblers of all different types of warblers coming through there. I even saw a whooping crane the one year I was going down there. So it's just, people don't realize the value of these wildlife refuges. I mean, typically during the week, you hardly see anybody out there. You'll see a few local people, bird watchers, whatnot. But it's a growing outdoor activity. They estimate they have about 10 million bird watchers coming to Texas every year now.
Wow. Well, that's got to be a tremendous contributor to the economy.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. In fact, Harlequin, Texas, is down near Brownsville, Texas, in that area. They have a big event every year for migration and migrating birds, but people come from all over the world to see the birds down there migrating, some that you can't see anywhere else. But it's a different world out there. Roger Torrey Peterson, one of his last talks was down there and on the Texas coast, and one of the things that he said was, get out and look at all these different birds today, because they're not going to be around much longer at the rate that human populations are growing and expanding. We're just not leaving enough for wildlife. And what you have to consider, just in the last 150 years, our population has gone from, for the first time, the world population in the early 1900s was just over a billion. Now we're over 6 billion. And this world's never seen this many people before. And we still celebrate, oh, we've got this family that's got 19 children. But when you look at the impact that puts on the environment for each one of those kids going out, I mean, I'm all for people having families. We came from a pretty good size. I have three brothers, but I think those days are gone. The big families are gone. I think people are a little bit greedy when they have more than they can support, or more than this earth can support.
So what's the state of... Go ahead.
No, go on.
So what's the state of our birds of prey and so forth now? I mean, what are you seeing in your research, for instance, there in Georgia?
Well, the birds aren't being shot like they used to be. It used to be that even the Fish and Wildlife Service had a bounty on birds of prey. Even eagles had a bounty on them. Our American eagle had a bounty on them. And that's all changed now. And I'm not saying that when I say the birds are being shot, I'm not saying they're being shot by hunters. They're being shot by fools with a gun. And a fool with a gun, they're shooting people or shooting each other.
Right.
True hunter's not going to go out and shoot a bird of prey. And a lot of it is education. People have learned that birds of prey are actually an important part of the prey that's out there. Like quail hunters, for instance, if it wasn't for Cooper's hawks and hawks hunting quail wouldn't fly so fast. They'd be running on the ground. They wouldn't need to fly. they wouldn't need to be able to fly really fast. So there's a connection there that, well, we're all connected with it. We need each other. We need the birds of prey, and people are learning that now. It's not like it was in the past, where if a hawk came down and killed your chicken, that was right after the Depression, that was taking food out of your family's mouths. But now we have a grocery store on every corner, and we're not having to compete with the wild hawks. Although I've got one that hits my yard every other day, going after my chickens, but I just get more roosters. I just get more roosters for him and say, well, that's just part of it. I don't know what the solution is, but I know if we don't start addressing it, and I don't ever hear the politicians talking about overpopulation of humans anymore. We hear about all the different things that we've got to do to be able to survive and to cut greenhouse gases and everything else, but we don't hear anything about maybe we shouldn't be breeding so much because people do consume so much in resources. It's just not feasible.
Well, it's become a crowded planet. That's obvious. We can see it in our cities and even out here in Clinton Falls, Indiana, you know, we see new houses going up what was once farmland, which is still mainly farmland, but we see parts of that being sold off and people building homes. It's definitely getting a little bit more crowded, but some parts of the wildlife, they tell us, like, for instance, deer, there's more than there were here 200 years ago, but basically we've created a habitat for deer. They like to live along the edge of forests and fields, and heck, that's all we have here, so the deer population is quite healthy. And but you're absolutely right. I mean, this planet of ours, and you know what we hope when we talk about saving wildlife, protecting wildlife, and yourself being an ambassador for the birds of prey and the other animals that you work with, that these school children, the message does get across. And I can still, right now we're lecturing with wolves, and when I tell them at one time the government paid to have wolves killed, the kids can't believe it. Because now, of course, people are more educated, I think, thanks to things like the Discovery Channel and Animal Planet, and the word's getting out that these animals are important. And I said 25 years ago, the mentality when I lectured with a wolf is entirely different. Today,
absolutely.
People seem to have a better understanding. So, you know, I still have faith. I think, you know, 99% of these folks on this planet are good people, and they want to make
absolutely.
Sure when they grow up, that their kids grow up, that there'll be a wild world, a place for youngsters to enjoy. And if they want to become a Steve Hoddy and be a lecturer, they can have that opportunity. And hopefully, there won't be so many laws passed that, as you said, hopefully we will not be an endangered species. That's what I hope. Steve, it's been fantastic. I knew you'd be a great guest. where's your website at so our listeners can check you out?
Earthquest.org.
Earthquest.org.
Earthquest.org. You can see us at the Georgia Renaissance Festival and the New York Renaissance Festival.
And when's that coming up?
In April 22nd through June 6th.
April 22nd through
June 6th.
Okay.
And then August and September in New York near Tuxedo Park.
Wow. Well, I hope you have a chance to get over my way. I'd love to see you again. It's been a while, and we chat on the phone. And as I've told many of the people in the wildlife, I don't want to say business, but to do what we do, that I'm friends with one of the best bird of prey handlers in the country, without a doubt. There's such a title as Master Falconer. that title should be given to Steve Hotty because he's absolutely amazing. Steve, I thank you for being on the show.
Well, thank you, Larry, and appreciate you getting a hold of us. And you keep up the good work as well.
Well, we're going to try. Next week on this program, we're going to Chautauqua Lake way up in New York and talk to Mr. Peter Weimer, and he's going to he's got some fantastic education programs for children with fishing and boating, and it's going to be fantastic. We'll be back next Thursday. This is Larry Batson, and this is Blog Talk Radio, and you've been listening to Larry Batson's Wild World.
Okay, Larry.
Thanks for listening this week to Larry Batson's Wild World. Be sure to join us again next week at 10 p.m. for more of the latest outdoor and wildlife news and information, along with great tales from your host, world-renowned wildlife expert, Mr. Larry Batson. Tune in again next week for another exciting edition of Larry Batson's Wild World. Larry Batson's Wild World is a Batson Wildlife Educational Services production in association with Blog Talk Radio.